Thanks for listening to Here and Now. We want to know about your experience listening to this podcast, what you like and don't like. If you have suggestions or feedback, send us an email at hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, Washington State asks an additional question of 911 callers. Is the person in trouble in the military?
But first, in Yemen, thousands of protesters took to the streets today, a day after the president and the rest of his government resigned in a standoff with rebels. Yemen's last government was overthrown in the Arab Spring of 2011, and the president who was ousted back then may now return to power. Either way, the ouster of the government yesterday deals another blow to the Arab Spring movement in the Middle East, almost 4 years to the day after the first street protest started in Cairo, Egypt, which came just days after Tunisians ousted their longtime leader. Fawa Gerges is professor of international relations at the London School of Economics and Political Science and author of The New Middle East, Protest and Revolution in the Arab World. He joins us via Skype. Fawaz, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, was the Arab Spring a failure?
Well, I think if you look at the Arab Spring in terms of an instant delivery of results, it has been a failure. But the Arab Spring uprisings is a historical process, a process of accumulation, a process that has witnessed major social and political struggles. We're talking about a matter of years, a matter of decades, not a matter of 3 or 4 years. In comparative historical terms, what's happening in the Arab world is quite very natural. What you have is that the ouster of authoritarian regimes has unleashed different competing social and political forces. And it's going to take some time, probably 5 or 10 years, for the dust to settle on the battlefield. Because the struggle in the Arab world, whether you're talking about Syria or Iraq or Tunisia or Yemen or Bahrain, it's a struggle about the identity of the state. It's a struggle about what kind of constitutions these Arab states should have. It's a struggle about what kind of the role of the sacred in the political process, the role of minorities. There is no consensus among the leading social and political forces in the region because for the last 50 or 60 years, authoritarianism was the dominant force and civil societies were suppressed by military-based regimes, and that's why the turmoil and that's why the fierce social and political and military struggles that we have witnessed in the last 4 years or so.
But if you look at the Arab Spring countries and you see Tunisia, it has been a somewhat of a success story. It recently held its first free elections. But then Egypt has gone back to a military-backed government. Syria, as we say, is in civil war. Libya is a mess. Protests in Bahrain were squashed by Saudi Arabia. Are you ever going to have a moment again where the people of some of these countries are willing to rise up against their government to demand what they want in their representation when you see that every time, with one exception now, Tunisia, that every time they overthrew the government and put in a different person, that fell apart?
Well, look, there is no going back in the Arab Middle East. Setbacks are to be expected. Counter-revolutionary forces are doing their best to return to the old order. But what has happened is that the psychology and the mood of the Arab people have changed. What you have in Syria, I mean, think what Assad has done in the last 3 years and a half or so. Despite everything that Assad has done, the people are still revolting against the system. In Tunisia, after 2-3 years, a fierce social and political struggle, a relative consensus has emerged. Egypt is in the grip of a major battle between the Islamists on the one hand and the nationalist forces led by the military. But if the new government, if the new regime in Egypt does not deliver in 1 or 2 years, don't be shocked if you witness another major wave of protests. And yes, in the meantime, in the short term and midterm, we are to expect a great social and political upheaval. Other societies in a similar historical situation did go through a similar process. All I am saying, it's what's happening in the region is not unique. What we are witnessing is basically painful birth banks. These are the painful birth banks of societies that are trying to overcome years and decades of authoritarianism and autocracy.
How do you think the U.S. handled the situation? Is there anything the U.S. could have done differently to support some of these new governments? And we look right at Yemen, where the U.S. was backing the government that just collapsed yesterday.
It's not just the United States of America. It's also the international community. The international community, whether we're talking about the European Union or the United States, did not invest any major political and military and material basically capital in trying to help transitioning Arab societies. The United States was very much preoccupied with its economic crisis. Europe is inward looking. Yes, the United States invested a bit of political capital in Yemen, trying to really help the transition from the authoritarian regime of Ali Abdullah Saleh to the current regime. But Yemen has many problems, as you know, and to say that the United States could have really made a difference in Yemen is to underestimate the complexity, even though I would argue that the intervention of the international community on the side of Arab society could have basically helped Arab societies make the transition in a much healthier and less violent means than what we have witnessed so far in the last 4 years.
That's Fawaz Jerjes, a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics and author of The New Middle East, Protest and Revolution in the Arab World. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, here at home, new recruits at Washington State's Law Enforcement Academy are now learning how to handle police 911 calls that involve military personnel and veterans. Washington is home to more than 65,000 active duty service members and more than 600,000 veterans. The training helps police recognize the challenges that some service members face when they return home from war, as well as the potential challenges they may pose to law enforcement. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, KUOW's Patricia Murphy has more.
Auburn, Washington, police officer Andy Gould is out on patrol. A computer screen in his car rhythmically ticks off details of emergencies from dispatch. He's just wrapped up a burglary call.
2 out of 50, you can clear that follow-up on 7th as a Tom, and I'll take the suspicious subject on 37th.
As Gould drives, text from the dispatchers scrolls up the screen. It tells him where to go for his next call, what the problem is, and whether the people involved have ever been in the military.
That said no military history. Is that standard in there?
Real-time on video and audio.
Interesting.
Available to hear the 13-year-old stating he's going to kill her and her boyfriend while they're sleeping.
Gould says dispatchers started asking about military experience a few years ago.
It's the training, because if we have a guy that we're looking for, and he's the suspect in a crime, and they tell us he has, and they ask that question. The purpose for that is because he has elevated training that could be a danger to us. He knows how to shoot, move, and communicate.
Gould, a combat veteran himself, says his military experience sometimes helps him establish rapport with other veterans, but not always.
Especially when, you know, when we're responding to someone in a mental crisis, and they're not the one that called. Sometimes they're not very happy when we get there.
Gould remembers one call about an armed man threatening suicide. He was a Marine veteran and had barricaded himself in his apartment with a shotgun. Dispatchers learned that the man was part of a Marine unit called First FAST.
FAST is Fleet Anti-Terrorism Security Teams.
Gould knew from his time in the Marines that the man was highly trained.
You have to take that into consideration when you're setting up and trying to deal with that guy, because if he really wanted to wreak some havoc, he certainly could. And had I not been there to tell my fellow officers that, no, this guy's highly trained, you know, let's, you know, be very, very careful, they would have went right over their heads.
So the next hour is going to be spent on both education, understanding, and some resources on veterans. And Josh is going to take you.
This class is intended to make sure a person's military background doesn't go over a police officer's head. At the Washington State Criminal Justice Training Center in Burien, about 24 officers from Seattle and Auburn participate in a 40-hour crisis intervention training program. Former Marine Josh Penner told the class that veterans are often stereotyped.
There's a lot of incorrect ways veterans or law enforcement officers are identified by the general public. right? We got gender, shape, color, religion, all the way down to behavior. Veteran lost his home, nearly committed suicide.
He says while, of course, not every veteran has mental health problems, people who've served in the military can be culturally different. They're used to using acronyms. When they use salty language, he says, it means they like you. And in some cases, they've been trained to react differently under pressure. Bob Graham has managed the program since it was established in 2008.
So identification and de-escalation are the main topic areas that we try to focus on. First of all, if they can identify that they're a veteran, that opens a different gamut of de-escalation tools that you can use. And you were at the training, so you heard some of those, and you know, have things be mission specific and identify that. And if you have officers that have a veteran background, they're going to be more effective at de-escalation and connecting with those folks.
A good portion of the class focuses on how to connect people in crisis to veteran or civilian resources. Graham says officers should look beyond the immediate situation.
You might be able to clear this call in 15 minutes, but if you take 45 minutes to do it and do a good job and hook them up with resources, you're not going to be back tomorrow, next week, three times this month.
Back in Auburn, that's what Officer Andy Gould and his colleagues tried to do when they encountered that suicidal ex-Marine. They talked with him and persuaded him to put down his shotgun and leave his apartment.
And he was at that point very cooperative. Once he got outside, you know, he was having an emotional breakdown. He was legitimately having some issues and was in a mental crisis. And so we got an ambulance and we were going to have an involuntary commitment.
In Auburn, where 8% of the population has served in the military, crisis response training is mandatory for all officers. In Seattle, a shorter abbreviated training is required, but the longer course is optional. Overall, more than half of Washington State's law enforcement agencies have officers who are trained in how to defuse people in a mental health crisis. For Here and Now, I'm Patricia Murphy.
For the first time since 9/11, our combat mission in Afghanistan is over.
President Obama in his State of the Union address Tuesday. Of course, the mission is formally over, but there are still more than 10,000 U.S. troops working in Afghanistan, and more than 2,000 American troops died there. How will history view this war? Veteran war correspondent Jack Fairweather says it could turn out to be the defining tragedy of the 21st century. We'd add that's saying something, since it has a lot of competition. In the first few pages of Jack's new book, we get this kind of detail. Some Afghans believed that Americans trained mice to run up cable to surveillance balloons, collect information, and run back down. Members of the Bush administration huddled at Camp David, figuring out a response to 9/11. Attorney General John Ashcroft sat down at the piano to bang out "Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen" while President Bush did a jigsaw puzzle. We also learned that Afghan President Hamid Karzai fell into a depression, blamed himself for the wreckage his country had become after 13 years of war, until he decided he didn't wreck the country. The Westerners who portrayed the ideals of the good war did. The book is called The Good War, Why We Couldn't Win the War or the Peace in Afghanistan. And Jack Fairweather joins us from Istanbul, where he now lives. Jack, just remind us, the good war, what was that?
On the one hand, the good war was the effort to get rid of al-Qaeda and remove that threat that had led to 9/11. On another hand, it was the effort to rebuild Afghanistan, a country shattered by 20 years of war since the Soviet occupation in the 1970s. And on the promise of rebuilding the country, the US, the international community, committed to a multi-year nation-building project, which started in 2001. Was optimistically meant to end a few years later and continues to this day.
And you say the idea was destined for failure, not because of history showed it didn't work, but because the U.S. overinflated the Taliban and al-Qaeda.
There was a fundamental mistake that was made in conflating the threat posed by al-Qaeda with that of the Taliban. Al-Qaeda was this international jihadist group that had already killed thousands of Americans. The Taliban was a much more local, tribally based organization that ran a repressive regime in Afghanistan. And you may remember that famous speech by Bush on September 20th, 2001, where he said, "You're either with us or against us." And in sort of setting up the rhetoric for what became the war on terror, he lumped together al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The US military got rid of al-Qaeda from Afghanistan pretty quickly. But then they started fighting and targeting and arresting, detaining Taliban fighters. And I think one of the great mistakes of the war that's not fully appreciated was the way in which Taliban commanders who were ready to lay down their arms were riled up by US actions. There was a major error that I think is every bit as great as the one when we think about the Iraq War, the decision to disband the military and criminalize Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party. This had a similar effect, alienating a large portion of southern Afghanistan.
What about Hamid Karzai, the president? You paint incredible pictures of him as a man with a motley following of just a handful of people who went by himself to attack the Taliban and was captured, and just almost this sort of cowboy scenario. How would you characterize him? Is he a villain in the book? Was he mistreated by the U.S.? How would you characterize it?
Hamid Karzai is one of the victims of the war and really at the vortex of our misconception of the type of war we were fighting in the early days when he emerged, as you say, from this grand escapade in the south as the leader of the country. He was lionized by the U.S. And held up as a sort of Gandhi-like figure who was going to bring democracy and Western institutions to the country. He was much more a sort of tribal leader, used to tribal systems of governance. And instead, Karzai went from being the great hero to the great villain by in the latter stages of the war, when he was held up as being not much better than a mobster, a petty criminal whose family was engaged in all sorts of nefarious activities. And, you know, as ever, when there are two extremes, the answer is somewhere in between. And I think one of the mistakes of the war was not to recognize what Karzai was about and take him on and work with him on his own terms rather than those we sought to impose on him and the country.
Now, he becomes almost a Shakespearean figure, kind of continually walking in these circles trying to figure out what went wrong. What about President Obama? How do you think history will look at President Obama's role in the surge and in ultimately embracing the notion of a good war?
I think if future presidents want a textbook on how not to manage a war, they will look at the first year of Obama's presidency with regard to Afghanistan. I think what he quickly realized that Afghanistan was vastly more complicated than he had gave it credence to on the campaign trail, and that more troops wasn't necessarily the answer. And that key realization was one that he didn't unfortunately act upon. Instead, he began a long, bitter, confusing process of review. He ended up committing the US to a strategy that was neither full-blown counterinsurgency as the generals wanted, nor a much more limited counterinsurgency as someone on Obama's team requested.
Well, look, you end your book with a quote from the former U.S. Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, who had a change of heart after the Vietnam War, years after, and came to see the folly and wrote, "We viewed the people and leaders of South Vietnam in terms of our own experience. We do not have the God-given right to shape every nation in our own image or as we choose." Then you go on to write, "The damage of these misconceptions in Afghanistan has been great, yet even now it's not too late to chart a different course." How?
I think those who knew Afghanistan in 2001 and visit the capital now, Kabul, you know, are amazed by the transformations that have taken place from a war-torn, barely functioning city to one in which, you know, there are in some places shopping malls springing up, some roads are being paved, and there's a change. I always think back to a trip I made to Afghanistan in 2012 when I went out to a outpost in Helmand with the U.S. military to an Afghan police checkpoint, and the police radio was on, And the Afghan police officer was having a conversation with his Taliban opposite number about 400 yards away. And they were exchanging insults at first, but then as the sort of sun began to set, they began singing songs to each other. And before you knew it, they were talking about their girlfriends, talking about, you know, their teenage hopes and dreams. And if the West can help that police officer and that Taliban teenager find common ground, that's where the future lies. And, you know, from that experience at that checkpoint, I don't think that, you know, their differences are so great that they can't be resolved.
Well, we'll leave it on that hopeful note. Jack Fairweather, his new book is The Good War, Why We Couldn't Win the War or the Peace in Afghanistan. We'll have an excerpt for you at hereandnow.org. Jack, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Sony said today it will miss a deadline to file its third quarter earnings report, and it's blaming November's cyber attack. That attack came just before Sony Pictures released the film The Interview about a fictional assassination plot against North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The U.S. government says North Korea was behind the hack, and according to Sony, the hack disrupted a major part of its computer systems, and that's why it has to delay its earnings report. Mike Regan of Bloomberg News joins us now, and Mike, why would the hack delay Sony's reporting?
Well, as the company said in a statement today, it destroyed much of the network that Sony Pictures' accounting system is based on. So hardware and was destroyed, large amounts of data was compromised. And really, when you think of the everything that goes into a company of that size with that many different divisions, compiling an earnings report for the quarter, it's a pretty elaborate process. And once they're done with it, it still has to go to outside auditors to check and sign off on. So, you know, obviously, this damage to these computers was so great. As you said, this happened in November.
Yeah.
And they were supposed to report on February 4th, and now they're pushing the deadline all the way to March 31st. They're basically saying, you know, they had to take – Sony Pictures had to take their accounting computers offline for several months during this, and they were very worried about restarting them prematurely and causing damage to the rest of their system. So it really, you know, it sort of gives you an idea of how much damage was done by this hack.
Well, and how big a deal is it for a company to say we're not going to report our earnings on schedule? How often does this kind of thing happen?
It's not uncommon for sort of smaller, younger companies. It is very, very rare for a company of this size to do it. And it usually happens in times of, you know, turmoil with the company, either, you know, in Japan, for example, in 2011, there were some delayed reports because of the earthquake. Petrobras, the big Brazilian oil producer, delayed a report last year, but because they were being investigated for bribery. So it's never a good sign. And it's kind of telling that Sony released this after the markets closed on Friday, which is generally a time when companies, you know, release bad news like this in a way to sort of minimize any impact on their stock price in the stock market.
After the markets closed in Japan. And I think one of the questions people may have is, are they simply delaying because this report is going to be really bad, that the company just doesn't hasn't figured out how to release this information and explain it? Were these hacks so bad for Sony's bottom line that this report is just really bad?
You know, the analyst, one analyst estimate I saw, an analyst at BGC Partners, said that the cost from the hack are about $169 million, which when you think of Sony, it's a company in the neighborhood of $80 billion worth of revenue in a year. So it's that type of cost is more like a rounding area. But that said, no one, you know, that's a guess from an analyst. We, you know, everyone really is waiting for Sony to detail exactly the cost. And, you know, that everyone was sort of looking forward to this report to do that. So, you know, it's really anybody's guess, the ultimate dollar figure hit that they'll take from this. But it really, you know, from their statement today, they really focused on just the damage done to the systems and just the, you know, sort of impossibility of them to be able to get the numbers together in time. You know, once they get the systems back online in February so that they're confident that everything's working the way they should be, then they're really going to have to go back and re-input about, you know, a few months worth of transactions.
Yeah.
just to get those numbers for that unit. So it's a quite an elaborate process.
Well, and I imagine a lot of other companies are going to be looking at this and saying, what can we learn from what Sony did right and what Sony did wrong. And as you say, this story continues, and Sony is still dealing with it. Mike Regan of Bloomberg News, thanks as always.
Oh, thank you.
300 vials of an experimental Ebola vaccine are expected to arrive in Liberia today. Ebola healthcare workers there will be the first to receive the vaccine in a trial, which eventually could expand to 30,000 people. Meanwhile, in Guinea, workers are still struggling to end the epidemic, but the World Health Organization said this week that the number of new weekly cases there is dropping steadily. NPR's Africa correspondent Ophébia Quist-Arkton joins us on the line from Guinea. Ophébia, welcome back.
Greetings.
And you're in Conakry, the capital, the largest city in Guinea. You were there in Guinea last April. What's different now?
You know, what has struck me is that in April last year, everybody would greet you, but nobody would stretch out their hand to shake your hand. No touching, no contact was one of the cardinal rules of this Ebola outbreak. But now we're finding that people want to shake our hands. People are shaking hands one with the other. Schools have reopened. They reopened on Monday, and many parents have sent their kids back to school, but many children are being kept away because parents are still worried. They're jittery. They don't think that it's safe yet to be able to send children back to schools.
And the government has a new initiative, zero cases of Ebola in 60 days, which would put us in mid-March. What's being done to try to meet that goal?
It was just launched on Saturday, the day we arrived in Guinea, and there was a rousing welcome for the initiative at the Palais du Peuple, which is the People's Palace and the main meeting centre here. But although the authorities are saying we want zero cases within the next couple of months, those who are dealing on the ground with the Ebola outbreak, such as Doctors Without Borders, the first responders on the scene here back in March, April last year, they're saying it's good, yes, that the number of new cases is going down, but there are still pockets of cases and especially pockets of resistance and denial. So people shouldn't jubilate yet. There is a long way to go. And until there are zero cases here in Guinea and neighboring Sierra Leone and neighboring Liberia, this epidemic is not over.
And there are some concerning reports about resistance among the population. Ophébia, tell us about that, that people are not still comfortable with Ebola workers.
Indeed, and it's a huge problem here. Health workers and others say that there are areas where people are still saying Ebola does not exist. And this has taken the form of attacking health workers who try to set up Ebola transit camps or Ebola treatment units. And probably even more worrying is the fact that there are still secret and unsafe burials because people are hiding Ebola patients. Of course, when they die, they are not telling the authorities. So they bury them. And what is spreading Ebola most, we're told, is these secret burials. The fact that people, to show their respect for those that have died, are doing the laying on of hands, they are kissing corpses. And of course, dead bodies are even more toxic with Ebola than people who are sick with the disease. So these are the priorities that the government here is saying, we must stop this. Those who continue to hide sick patients and conduct unsafe burials will be prosecuted.
NPR's Ophébia Quist-Arkton, our Africa correspondent, speaking with us from Conakry, the capital of Guinea. Ophébia, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
And now let's head to Greece, where there will be elections on Sunday, and a charismatic young leftist named Alexis Tsipras could end up being the next prime minister. He has promised to end painful austerity measures while stimulating the country's ravaged economy, but he may be on a collision course with those in Europe who have lent Greece billions of dollars worth of bailout loans. Joanna Kakissis reports from Athens.
Greeks first saw Alexis Tsipras in 1990 when he was a communist teenager in a pompadour leading student protests against a conservative government. His ideas may have been radical, but he spoke with a telegenic confidence, says Matheos Tsimitakis, who was also involved in those protests.
Calm kid, like moderate, pragmatist, you know, did politics even then.
politics, especially the grassroots left, would define Tsipras over the years, even as he grew more moderate. He ran for Athens mayor in 2005 and had a strong showing. In 2008, he took over leadership of Syriza, then an obscure leftist party that included everyone from Maoists to moderates. In the last 4 years, Syriza, under the leadership of Tsipras, has led the wave of anger against austerity measures that have crushed Greeks. The party is now leading in all public opinion polls. At a crowded campaign rally, Tsipras takes the stage like a prime minister in waiting. Christoforos Vernadakis, a former pollster who's now running for parliament on the Syriza ticket, is at the rally too.
Alexis represents something new, which is what Greeks need right now. He's just 40 years old and not part of a political family or the old political system. No one can hitch the mistakes of the past on him.
And Tsipras hammers home those mistakes at every opportunity. In a recent TV interview, he blamed the current government of Prime Minister Andonis Samaras for conspiring with Eurozone lenders to tax poor and middle-class Greeks and letting the rich off the hook.
Should anyone be afraid of our tax policy? Yes, the people who are the biggest tax evaders. They should be afraid.
His fight for the little guy is paying off at home, but it's unclear how a Prime Minister Tsipras would deal with European leaders such as Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany, which has lent Greece billions in the bailout deal. Tsimitakis, now a journalist for Syriza's official newspaper, Avyi, says Tsipras hopes to appeal for debt relief by arguing that the Greek crisis is not just a local one.
It really is a European problem. I think he has a pretty realistic basis to go and actually say that we need to turn to growth policies. There will be people there to listen.
Tsipras may find it challenging to convince European leaders, but he's inspired some Europeans outside Greece, like Valeria Zanella, a market researcher who traveled from Italy to campaign for Tsipras.
They have to listen. If Tsipras will win, he will be the chief, and so they must.
For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Athens.
And let's go now on stage. Our look at what's happening on the boards across the country, from talent shows to marching band competitions to today, the ultimate stage, perhaps, Broadway. Here's some sound from the new production of Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods.
What a beautiful cape!
Stay away from my cape or I'll slice you into a thousand bits.
The woods without delay.
Be careful not to lose the way. Into the woods, who knows?
Well, look, Milky White, it's the butcher. Baker!
Sound from Into the Woods, which opened last night at the Laura Pels Theater in New York. Gee, I wonder if it's any good. Well, why don't we ask one of New York's top theater critics about that and other productions? New York Times theater critic Ben Brantley joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, some people get to go to Broadway. The rest of us read your reviews.
I know how privileged I am.
Well, and we live vicariously. But just, you've really liked some things lately. So just broadly, is it a good time to go see some theater?
It's a surprisingly good time. January and February are generally considered the zombie months, you know, when shows are just sort of barely alive and people aren't going. But there have been two really exciting openings in the past month. There's a play out of England called Constellations by Nick Payne, and it stars Jake Gyllenhaal and Ruth Wilson, who just won a Golden Globe Great. Award for The Affair. It's a very classic, very simple story. If you boil it down, it's boy meets girl. Really, not much more than that, except it's boy meets girl, boy meets girl, boy meets girl from every angle you can imagine in parallel universes. So in other words, you say, hi, how are you doing? And she says, hi, how are you doing? And then they do it with every kind of inflection. So it might have led to a great date. It might have led to the two never speaking again. And it follows the relationship and the different courses it might have took. The whole thing lasts only 70 minutes. It's just the two of them on stage, almost no scenery except for a black box and white balloons. And it's the way you relive your life in your mind, as far as I'm concerned. Very, very touching.
Well, I mean, you use words like emotionally devastating, so sexy, so accessible.
Right.
One of the themes is physics.
Well, it is. It's according to the theories of string theory and relativity and quantum mechanics. And I don't want to give too much away about one of the courses it takes, but for anyone who's experienced any kind of loss of someone you love in recent years, it does hit very close to home.
Okay. Well, they are not even releasing any sound from this production. There's so much a buzz around it. Maybe they feel they don't have to, but we will take your word, Ben Brantley, about
I'll be happy to do both parts for you.
Well, perhaps another time.
Okay.
So there's Constellations, and then we want to hear your thoughts about a musical that you say is an old-fashioned, deeply satisfying Broadway musical in a way few new shows are anymore. It's Honeymoon in Vegas. It stars Tony Danza of Who's the Boss fame. It's about a man named Jack, played by Rob McClure, who's headed to Las Vegas with his longtime girlfriend, Betsy, played by Bryn O'Malley, to get married. This is Airport Song from Honeymoon in Vegas.
When can I get the next direct flight to Vegas?
Next Thursday.
Well, next Thursday? Are you insane?
Not to worry, sir.
We can get you there.
You can.
We could put you on the 9:15 to Honolulu, then to Atlanta, then on to Vegas for Wednesday morning. $8,000.
$8,000? I don't have a pot to piss in.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, Ben Brantley. everybody
here. You've been
here,
at that airport.
Everybody here was moving. It feels, okay, I'm in a musical. What are we seeing when this is happening, and what was so compelling for you?
Well, first of all, the idea of Las Vegas is, I think, regarded with a certain disdain in New York. It's considered sort of the capital of kitsch on the East Coast, whether justly or not. Nonetheless, this show takes what we associate with the Vegas sound. Jason Robert Brown did a fabulous job with the score of the 1960s when Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack roamed there, and turns it, but redefines it according to the principles of the Broadway musical. Very witty. It's based on Andrew Bergman's 1992 movie. He did the adaptation. And Tony Danza plays a high-stakes gambler with definite criminal associations, but in the style of Sinatra, very low-key, cool. It's a wonderful, eccentric star turn. But the whole thing is just a lot of fun, in the sense that old-fashioned musicals were.
Well, you write, let's pray that Honeymoon in Vegas does not disappear before it finds its audience. Does this mean someone might be able to get a ticket?
This is a show to which you can get a ticket now.
Okay, good.
And it sort of snuck into town. It didn't make any noise. It had opened at the Paper Mill Playhouse in New Jersey about a year and a half ago. Everyone loved it. And then suddenly it's in New York, and we kind of forgot it was there until the moment it opened. So I really hope that it does have some magnetic force for the tourist audience and for New Yorkers, too.
And for people saying, well, Tony Danza, he was a TV star. He has been in theater.
He has been in theater. I saw him in The Iceman Cometh with Kevin Spacey. He held his own. Mm-hmm. But this is a very controlled performance, and he's improved since I saw him at the Paper Mill. But just what he does with his voice, it's not a flat-out imitation of Sinatra, but it's a great homage to the Sinatra idea of cool.
Great. Can't wait to see that one, Honeymoon in Vegas. Let's move on to a show, Let the Right One In. It opened and did well in London and then opened this week at St. Anne's Warehouse in Brooklyn. Martin Quinn plays Oscar, a 12-year-old boy who lives in an apartment in Sweden and gets bullied sometimes. His new neighbor, a girl named Eli, also around 12, very understanding. Here they are on the playground. Eli, the young girl, discovers Oscar with a scratch across his cheek.
What happened to your face?
You said you were going to be here yesterday.
Something happened.
All the same, you promised.
No, I didn't promise. What happened to your face?
Well, I fell.
No, you didn't. Someone did that to you, didn't they?
I'm pulled in already. The young man later admits, yes, someone did. Ben Brantley, sort of a young love story, part vampire horror show. What's going on here?
Well, I mean, I thought I'd probably had enough of young vampires in love after the Twilight series, but this definitely rekindled my interest. It's based on, originally a Swedish movie that was in turn made and remade as an American movie. But the play really gets what was so great about the original, that sense of how, I mean, we all feel like Frinks is adolescence, whether we're bullied or not. And I think all of us, I think there's a reason that kids identify with young vampires. There's something about this sense of being never quite fitting in, never quite finding who you are. And then you do meet a fellow freak with whom you connect. And the freak in this case happens to be an undead girl who is magnificently played.
Well, there you go. Ben Branley, New York Times theater critic, with his picks for theater that you must check out in New York. Ben, you also recommended Into the Woods. We heard a little at the top, but a few words about this current production.
Well, I know the movie's out there now. This is kind of the opposite of that. It's nothing Disney about it. It's very stripped down, cast of 10, but it's the best presentation, the clearest, the liveliest of this classic Sondheim musical that I've ever seen.
Wow, because you've seen them all. New York Times theater critic Ben Brantley, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, Donna, didn't I tell you then? That no matter what, I would be with you again. Wow, Donna, can you believe it's true?
And that is Tony Danza singing A Little Luck. The song is from the Broadway musical Honeymoon in Vegas that we just heard was so loved. But it is a private performance for the New York Times. The show's composer, Jason Robert Brown, on piano. And Jeremy, I'm calling Ticketmaster.
I'm looking for train tickets to New York right now.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.